It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has a new state budget plan in place.
The budget includes a significant portion covered in a bipartisan deal between Governor Tony Evers and Republican leaders in the legislature.
Lawmakers voted to approve the budget yesterday, and Governor Evers signed it with some partial vetoes at 1:30 this morning. We're catching up on what is and isn't included in the budget.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's state capitol reporter. Anya, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And Rich Kramer is political reporter for WPR based out of Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Anya, you were at the Capitol all day long, I understand. You watched Governor Evers sign this thing. Take us through this. How did the discussion of votes on this budget shake out between the two parties leading up to a long night for you?
Oh, yeah. It was a long night for a lot of people, I think. Debate kind of went on all day and well into the night. Part of that was because Democrats were introducing a lot of amendments during the debates in both the Senate and the Assembly. A lot of them arguing that the bill just sort of doesn't go far enough on some of their priorities, like childcare or education, or they wanted to push programs that, like postpartum Medicaid expansion, for example, or free school lunches that wasn't in the final document. So things started off pretty timely in the Senate. We kind of expected for there to be these longer speeches and the work on the amendments. But then there was a big sort of recess before votes and before it got sent to the Assembly. And that certainly had some people that I was talking to kind of nervous that things would not end up wrapping up quite so cleanly. But it did. The Assembly then kind of did their thing. About 6 hours of debate there. They wrapped up after midnight. And then we reporters all ran to the governor's office to watch him sign it into law, which is a pretty speedy turnaround time.
And Rich, this was kind of slow and leisurely until it wasn't. We had this official June 30th deadline that didn't really matter. You know, the state doesn't shut down if you didn't hit that. All of a sudden, there's this thing coming from the federal government. What accelerated the timeline here?
Yeah, it was essentially a race between federal and state lawmakers to pass their budgets. You know, there's the federal deadline that is essentially arbitrary and was set by President Donald Trump. He wants his spending bill, known as the Big Beautiful Bill Act, to pass by July 4th. But the hurry in Wisconsin, over the last couple days, had to do with Medicaid funding. And so it boils down to this. Wisconsin has something called a Wisconsin Hospital Assessment. That's a tax on health providers' net patient revenue. So that money is leveraged to get a federal match, and it goes back to reimburse hospitals for treating low-income individuals. And a chunk of that also goes into the state's medical assistance fund, which essentially bolsters Medicaid, what we know as Badger Care. Wisconsin's assessment had been 1.8% since 2009. The budget upped it to 6%. What that means is more money collected can bring in additional federal matching funds. We're talking about an additional $1.2 billion in Medicaid matching funds. The Wisconsin Hospital Association says hospitals in Wisconsin will see around $700 million more each year, and that'll cover about half of their losses. But if Wisconsin didn't pass its budget before the federal lawmakers did and before President Trump signed his bill, we'd be locked in at that 1.8%.
That's one element of this state budget plan. Anya, another part, a tax cut. Republican State Senator Howard Markline and other Joint Finance Committee leaders held a press conference after the outlines of this agreement reached on Tuesday. They were talking about this $1.2 billion income tax cut they agreed on with Governor Evers. Here's a listen.
Tax rate is going to be reduced, which is going to have a meaningful impact on a lot of the average hardworking people in the state of Wisconsin.
Anya, this was something that had been talked about. It seemed like everybody on both sides of this agreed that there was going to be some kind of significant tax cut in this budget deal.
Yeah, that was sort of something that Republicans had said from the beginning was their non-negotiable. And then Evers on his side had some non-negotiables, including education funding and childcare funding. And so we learned about elements of this deal early Tuesday morning that Republican leaders and Governor Evers had struck that included kind of both of those elements. So as you say, about $1.4 billion in tax relief, with a couple other kind of little things in there too, like exempting some retirement income tax, that kind of thing, paired with about $1.2 billion in education, K through 12, higher education, I should say, K through 12, and child care stuff. And so that was kind of the first sign that something really was going to get across the finish line, because you had these two camps kind of getting some portion of what they want and coming forward and saying, we have this bipartisan budget deal. This will be going forward.
Rich, people have had their eyes on a point of contention. Universities of Wisconsin funding, the UW system funding, the Board of Regents asked for a $6 million or for a multi-million dollar increase. Governor Evers, too. Republicans in the Assembly said, hey, how about an $89 million cut? But one of their representatives told us on the show that's kind of a budget marker, a negotiating point. Where did we end up on UW system funding?
Yeah, I mean, the gulf between what the governor had suggested, which was essentially what the universities of Wisconsin had suggested, and what Assembly Speaker Voss and others had floated couldn't have been bigger. But the final product, this negotiated deal, includes $256 million in new spending on the UW, and that includes a stabilization fund, wage increases. Lawmakers and the governor also approved $840 million for building and renovation projects at campuses like UW-Madison, UW-Milwaukee, UW-Oshkosh, and others. So that's where we landed. There's also included in that deal a requirement that instructors will have to spend more hours in the classroom. And there's other bits, too, that some of the Democrats were not happy with last night. But I mean, that's compromise. It was just wild how different the numbers were. And I wouldn't say they landed in the middle, but, you know, not having seen all the numbers, it seems to be embraced by a lot of people.
We're talking about the state budget signed into law this morning. WPR political reporters Rich Kramer and Anya Van Wagtendonk are with us. Another big point of contention here, or a big question mark anyway, was the correctional system and how we're going to fund prisons, big changes possibly in the works. Republican Representative Mark Bourne talked earlier this week on what they arrived at with Governor Evers.
We're investing across the entire state system, including moving forward plans in the Department of Corrections to make sure that we right-size and innovate in that area for the future.
And at the heart of this was a plan to close the Green Bay Correctional Institution, Anya, which I think most parties wanted to do. The question was, what happens next? Governor Evers had kind of an intricate plan. Where did we land on all of that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So earlier this year, just to back up a little bit, in his own budget proposal, Governor Evers proposed closing Green Bay by 2029. That same date was in the Republican budget proposal. The Evers plan, as you say, was an intricate one. It was a series of dominoes is kind of how it was explained. So they put forward, you know, this place has to close so that this place can absorb these things and be restructured in this way, this very, very step-by-step, multi-tiered, complicated process that would culminate in the closure of Green Bay. And so when Representative Bourne sort of announced that Republicans were putting forward that same idea, it is true that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle support closing the Institute. Actually, the town that the facility is in supports closing it. It's kind of a notorious prison, dangerous conditions. It's quite old. It's quite outdated. But one of the things that happened last night at the signing ceremony, Governor Evers has a partial veto pen, so he can strike words and numbers and things like this. And the thing that he struck was not the money for DOC and not closing Green Bay, but he struck the year 2029. So in other words, he was saying, we're not going to kind of force the hand of DOC. And what he said was, we were able to compromise on this budget. We need to compromise on how we get to closing Green Bay. Everybody wants to close Green Bay, but I need Republicans to come to the table and work with me on a plan. So that was kind of where we landed. And so the answer is, we don't know where we landed exactly with that timeline.
Another big question mark, child care funding. Governor Evers made a big ask in his initial budget. Here's Democratic State Representative LaTanya Johnson making a pitch for state child care funding during Tuesday's joint finance meeting.
Solving Wisconsin's child care crisis, investing in the full ecosystem that families rely on, is essential to keeping families here, especially those of childbearing age.
Rich, where did we end up with child care funding in this budget?
Something like $300 million or more going into child care funding. So that money is going to be going to providers to kind of stabilize them. Also, there's going to be increased money for subsidies, essentially for parents that rely on those child care centers. So the governor hailed that as a really big deal for working parents and the state as a whole.
Anya, you mentioned the governor's partial veto pen. It's a unique situation in some ways here in Wisconsin. You mentioned striking that year on the prison closure deadline in the Green Bay area. Any other striking partial vetoes that you saw?
That's right. That was really kind of the most striking one in the past. People may remember the, quote, 400-year veto. So he's used his pen a little bit differently in the past. This time around, I would say he used it much more conservatively on about two dozen items. But it was primarily just to either lock in a higher amount of funding for certain programs. And so by removing the cut to funding, he locks in the previous spending numbers, and that was a way, according to him, to kind of prepare for potential federal funding cuts. And then he also, interestingly, made a couple cuts to specific DNR programs in an effort to say, let's get Knowles Nelson conservation funding to the table. That was something that didn't end up in the final budget. And so I think this was him attempting to use his pen to, again, get some people back to the table, but nothing too flashy or surprising and at 1:30 in the morning.
And we'll leave it there. Anya, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Rich, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR State Capitol reporter. Rich Kramer is a political reporter for WPR based out of Eau Claire. They have been following a speedy day in budget voting and signing. We have a state budget plan now passed yesterday by the state legislature, signed in the wee hours of the morning by Governor Evers. Go to WPR.org for more coverage, more details about what did and didn't make it into that budget plan.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the head of the state's Citizens Utility Board talks about decisions to keep coal power plants online and other issues affecting energy bills.
The big challenge now facing Wisconsin and many other states is the development of these data centers that are fueling so much growth in demand for energy.
That's next from WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A 63-year-old coal-fired power plant was set to permanently shut down in Michigan last month, but the Trump administration ordered it to keep operating, declaring an energy emergency.
Keeping the plant open could cost tens of millions of dollars and would be paid for by consumers, including people in Wisconsin. And there are other federal proposals that could affect people's energy bills.
The spending bill being debated by Congress would cut energy assistance programs that help low-income people heat and cool their homes.
To help sort out what energy policies we should be paying attention to and the latest developments affecting ratepayers, we turn to Tom Content, the executive director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. Tom, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Great to be back with you.
Let's start with coal. We Energies announcing that it will delay the closing of its two coal plants at Oak Creek until the end of next year. Those were originally planned to close this year. And the utility saying that, look, these plants are needed to meet energy demand. Are they? Are these plants needed?
Well, that's what they're saying. I think there's questions about how much is needed for the growth that is being talked about in the years ahead. It's true that across the Midwest, there are concerns about reliability generally that have led to higher prices in the wholesale market. We've argued that they approved a new natural gas plant to replace this, and that won't come on in line as fast as early next year. But it seems as though there are concerns about the summer months of 2026 in terms of reliability, but that across the region, I don't know that it's more of a Wisconsin situation or more of a Midwest situation where coal plants are being kept open, linked to that.
It makes me wonder as well. I mean, these plants, they date back to the 1960s. And have there been updates in decades since with these plants?
There have been upgrades. They actually spent, We Energy spent, was approved to spend about $1 billion for the old Oak Creek plant, which is the one we're talking about. It was built in the 50s and the 60s, just about 15 years ago or so. And that upgrade included pollution controls, you know, to make the, so that it would burn more clean than a very old coal plant. Mm-hmm. It still didn't do anything about carbon emissions, but it would help with conditions, impacts linked to coal, like asthma and other conditions, at least to some degree. And so one of the big issues that CUB has been fighting about is the costs to customers after these plants shut down, where customers are still forced to eat these costs or forced to pay for a power plant that's no longer needed to keep the lights on. In this case, they're saying it is needed to keep the lights on for one more year.
Let's look at our neighbor Michigan here, the Trump administration ordering the Campbell Power Plant in Michigan to keep operating. How could this affect Wisconsin residents?
Well, it's a couple ways. The first and foremost issue is that they're actually, the utility that's being required to keep the plant open is asking that everybody in Wisconsin, as well as other Midwest states, have to pay the costs of keeping that plant open. There's no firm estimate for how much it would cost, but the one estimate that's out there is about $100 million in costs. And they're experiencing, over at Consumers Energy in Michigan, they're experiencing these costs because they had pretty much used up their supply of coal for that plant, so they have to buy coal all over again, and they have to either retain workers who are already about to lose their jobs or hire new workers for that plant. So we're part of a group of consumer advocates and other groups, including Public Citizen, that are raising, that are challenging at the FERC in Washington, D.C., that these costs should be spread across the upper Midwest, including Wisconsin.
And the plant is part of the MISO network, where power is routinely bought and sold on. Meanwhile, we're hearing from the Trump administration that the Michigan plant needs to stay open because there's a national energy emergency. Do you think we're facing an energy crisis now?
I don't think so. There's not an imminent crisis. And in the case of keeping that coal plant open, it's actually kind of landlocked or waterlocked, if you will, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. of Michigan's status of being having three Great Lakes on its side. And so the transmission system is not robust in that area, or robust enough for the Campbell plant's power to really move into the rest of the region. And the Midwest grid operator had actually allowed this plant to shut down. It was proposed by Consumers Energy, and it was approved by the group. It's called MISO, but it's the group that basically is responsible for making sure the system's reliable. And so they didn't think there was an emergency when that plant was planning to shut down.
Tom, let's move over to solar and wind power. The International Energy Agency considers it the most affordable energy resources. Is there still a need for coal and gas power plants in our energy mix as we are seeing these solar and wind power projects coming online now?
There's a lot of solar and wind that's coming online, which has been very affordable. And the big challenge now facing Wisconsin and many other states is the development of these data centers that are fueling so much growth in demand for energy. And that's because one big data center from one of the big tech companies can use as much power as an entire city, which is mind-boggling when you think about it. It's just so much power for one site. And Wisconsin has multiple sites that are being looked at for data centers. And so that's the big challenge. And so the Public Service Commission just approved new natural gas plants at Oak Creek and in Kenosha County, in part linked to economic growth and which is being driven by the Microsoft project down there in Racine County.
I wonder, though, what if a data center project doesn't come to fruition? Do you have to put in those energy infrastructure investments before the data center is built? And what might that look like, perhaps overbuilding in energy?
That is exactly was at the heart of the case that was just decided. And for that reason, did not support the entire $2.2 billion of new natural gas infrastructure that was proposed, just because there's so much uncertainty about how much load growth, or as they call it, how much increased energy use there will be from these data centers. And there's a lot of hype. It's almost like a fever pitch about AI right now. We're hearing about it every day. An AI search uses, 8 or 10 times as much energy as a Google search. And so we're seeing the impacts of this. But the reality is there wasn't a lot of certainty about how much energy that Microsoft project would need, because Microsoft had initially proposed three campus project all basically in the same area. And they paused construction on the numbers 2 and 3. And so from that point of view, the environmental groups were certainly saying no fossil fuels, no new natural gas. And CUB ended up in a compromise position where we said build some, but don't build the whole thing until we know more about how much of this is actually going to be real.
Kind of reducing the risk and the exposure there. Tom Content is Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin as we talk about federal and state energy infrastructure issues and the impact on energy consumers. Moving over to Congress, as we watch the massive spending bill currently being debated, it would end subsidies for wind and solar projects, also impose an additional tax on clean energy businesses. As you look at this and things are changing, what would this do to the clean energy industry here in Wisconsin?
I think it's going to have a real impact, because we've been seeing a lot of growth in that sector, which has helped keep costs down for customers overall. And so it's a real concern, and we don't know what will come out of the end of this process, but both the House and Senate versions are much more restrictive on wind and solar than certainly and in fact, a lot of the clean energy tax credits are being rolled back as part of the whole tax cut, keeping the tax cuts from 2018 in place. It could actually end up with an impact for Wisconsinites through the state Focus on Energy program. Right now, there are programs available for homeowners around the state to actually add solar or do other things that are efficient in terms of adding insulation, doing air sealing at your house, doing energy or electrified appliances such as heat pumps. There are so many all these incentives that for now are in place, but they were going to be in place initially for 7 years or more. And now the question is, how long will they still be in place? But they're still available today.
And in the spending plan proposed by President Trump and Republicans, it would eliminate the low-income home energy assistance program, which helps people pay their heating and cooling bills. How would eliminating this program affect people in Wisconsin?
It's really significant. We wrote a letter to the congressional delegation on this, and so did a national group of consumer advocates also wrote letters on this, because this is a real impact. This is $4 billion across the country that's helping low-income customers pay their bills. And the concern, if Congress keeps this in place, and we won't know that for a while, because that's going to be in a different spending bill than the one that's been talked about recently. But starting in October, there may be no money instead of $4 billion. And just to put some numbers on it, for Wisconsin, about 260,000 households benefited from that in the last year or so, through energy assistance and a different form called crisis assistance within that. It's really sizable. There is a supplemental assistance program that Wisconsin has that would still be in place, but at a time when utility bills have been rising much faster than inflation across the state, and are proposed to keep rising across the state, it really is putting a lot of pressure on people who are already struggling to make ends meet and could face the threat of shutoff.
You mentioned rising utility bills, and one of the roles of your organization, Citizens Utility Board, is to advocate for customers on utility rates when they're set by the Public Service Commission. What rate cases should we be aware of right now and taking a look at?
Yeah, so basically last year the rates were decided for the eastern part of the state, We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service. And so what's before the PSC this year are the other three big utilities. That's Xcel Energy in western and northern Wisconsin, Alliant Energy, which is based in Madison and serves southwest Wisconsin, as well as other parts of the state, and Madison Gas and Electric. And together, all three of them are proposing about $450 million in higher costs that would take effect in January on both electric and natural gas costs. So it's pretty sizable. And for residential customers, over 2 years, it would be at the low end, 10% is the proposed increase for Madison Gas and Electric. And then the other two are in the teens or even higher in terms of the impact on residential customers over the next 2 years. And so we hope that people will pay attention to these cases. We have information about them on our website, cubwi.org, on our active cases page, so that people can know when the public hearings are going to be. Right now, they haven't been scheduled, but those would likely be in September or October.
What do the utilities say about their need to raise rates? And then, you know, what impact does that have on their profit rates and their bottom line?
Right. So there is a lot of investment going on, whether it's in the distribution system, kind of the local wires, not the big power lines, but the local wires that kind of connect power plants to the homes, as well as the solar and the battery and in some cases natural gas plants that have been built in recent years by some of these utilities. So a lot of investment is being built as part of the transition from coal to other fuels, and also to respond to economic development. So it's a lot that's coming at customers, especially when the second part you mentioned is the profits, because unfortunately the profit motive of the utilities is based on how much they build, and the more they build, the more they earn. And so on the earning side of things, that's where we think there's a real opportunity for savings. And we have seen savings in past cases when they bring down the profit level of the utilities. It can save hundreds of millions of dollars if the state regulators were were aggressive in kind of bringing profits down to where they're still monopolies are still financially healthy, but customers aren't overpaying. And our view is customers are definitely overpaying when it comes to the profit side of things.
So what options do people have in Wisconsin if they're struggling to pay their utility bills? If federal assistance is going away, where should they look to?
I think it's really important that that people raise their voice and speak out about their concerns about the rising prices, but also as a resource for people, that there is still energy assistance now. And we're hopeful that there will be a bipartisan agreement on the low-income heating assistance and weatherization cuts that have been proposed at the federal level. But there is still funding available now. But one of the best things that people can do, and this is available to low-income households too, actually, is take advantage of some of the programs that are available that I was talking about earlier concerning weatherizing your homes, because insulating your homes and weatherizing your homes it will lead not just to savings this year, but every year after it gets done, because a more comfortable place to live is actually a much more affordable place from a utility bill side of things.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be part of the conversation.
That is Tom Content, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. We've been talking about power plants and renewable energy and how federal and state actions will affect Wisconsin residents' energy bills.
Coming up, a new book shares the story of the award-winning cheese producers of Wisconsin's Driftless region.
We have exceptional cheese, number one. Number two, we live and create in the Driftless region. It's very special to us that live there and the products that are produced and the makers that make.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Driftless area in southwestern Wisconsin is known for its rolling hills and outdoor recreation, but it's also home to a beloved Wisconsin tradition, that is small-batch artisanal cheesemaking.
A new book showcases 12 cheesemakers from the Driftless area and traces the history of how the region became a dairy paradise. It's called The Wisconsin Way. That's W-H-E-Y.
The region is home to varieties from aged cheeses like Hook's 20-year cheddar to Pleasant Ridge Reserve and Alpine-style cheese that has received more awards than any other cheese in U.S. history.
Kristen Mitchell is the founder and owner of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point. She is a co-author of The Wisconsin Way, Cheesemaking in the Driftless. And Joe Burns is co-owner of Brunkow Cheese in Darlington. He's one of the featured cheesemakers in the book. Joe, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Kristen, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, people around the country, around the world may think, okay, Wisconsin equals cheese. True, in many ways. The Driftless area, though, Kristen, let's start with you. What is it that was inspiring enough about the cheese scene to say, hey, we need a book about this?
Well, we have exceptional cheese. Number one. Number two, we live and create in the Driftless region. It's very special to us that live there, the people that live there, and the products that are produced and the makers that make. So it just seemed like an appropriate way to showcase and honor a specific food that is being created to increase the visibility of the foodscape in the Driftless region.
And Joe, I see there's different people profiled in the book. You are one of them. And everybody in the cheese scene seems to come from a different background. Can you give us your origin story?
Yeah, mine's probably quite different than most of the others. I grew up in Nebraska, not Wisconsin. So I did not grow up, with a dad cheesemaker and following his footsteps or anything like that. I went from Nebraska to Chicago after college and was in the wine business for a few years. And long story short, kind of stumbled upon some cheese, I don't know, appreciation in that field, and noticed that there was kind of a lack of Wisconsin cheesemakers at Chicago farmers markets. So hooked up with some people at the Milk Marketing Board, which kind of led me to Brunkow, and honestly coming to visit them for the first time is the first time I actually saw the Driftless region. And it was really just the whole landscape that kind of captured me and made me want to like dive right in, and kind of snowballed from there and became immersed in the world of cheese here.
Yeah, you didn't grow up with cheese in your veins, but you end up now a co-owner there. What was the learning curve like? What did it take to become a cheesemaker yourself?
Well, you know, it's kind of crazy. Before I started making cheese, I started helping them sell it. And I saw some products that I thought would do well in Chicago that weren't being made here. Some more artisanal stuff rather than just kind of the specialty and commodity. And I don't know, they're just, you know, it's rural Fayette, salt of the earth people. An outsider like me comes in and says, hey, maybe we should try to make these products and maybe I'll give it a try. And you'd think anyone else would be like, you know, we've been doing this for 100 years. We don't really need your input. But they just said, let's try it, you know, jump on in. And it was just trial by error, just learning by following their lead and trying to come up with some new stuff. And it after a lot of failure, it finally worked.
And Kristen, this seems like a running theme among many of the cheesemakers. Yes, they're using time-honored methods in some cases, but there's also a lot of willingness to innovate, or collaborate with the university. Can you talk about that spirit of, hey, yeah, we are willing to try something new and different, or maybe bring back something old and different?
Mm. I think part of it is the culture of the Midwest, right? For the most part, we want to support each other. We want to help each other succeed. I think that's a significant part of it. But I think there's this very significant cooperative effort that we really saw meeting with all of the cheesemakers. They are the biggest champions of each other. You would think in an industry where it is making one product relatively consistently that there would be some, people being upset with each other because other people are stepping on their toes or trying to learn something. It is not that at all. So I think that was one of the beautiful things about creating the book, because it kind of mimics what we as, you know, because there's three collaborators of this book project, and we all felt the same way. How can we all help each other succeed? And if we can help each other succeed, how can we take that another step further? So I think a part of it is just the culture of the Midwest and specifically the Driftless region.
And Joe, I got that impression reading the book. It isn't like, hey, we're a bunch of cheesemakers in the same area and we're all in this bitter competition. It seems like this is a scene, like a music scene almost. Can you talk about that spirit?
Yeah. You know, I think this Driftless area, the southwest part of Wisconsin, I think it's always been progressive agriculture. So you have, cheesemakers in the same spirit trying new things, seeing what's being done in Europe and trying to make our own versions of it. And then, it's all small batch, artisanal style cheesemaking that's mostly in the book. And you just can't make that by the semi load. So you don't really think of the competition thing of it, because it's not a commodity. So even if I wanted to make a billion pounds of the cheese, I just can't. I make it by hand. So it's something that if you have a passion for that type of cheese, you're going to make it, whether you can make it, in large vats or small vats. And I think a lot of us in this area just come from that background of more of the smaller craft of it than the, commodity style. But, there's room for that too, of course. Mm-hmm. There's big factories for that, but there's also room for us small guys, and we're really not big enough to compete with each other.
And Kristen, that makes me think, again, reading the book, and I've talked to economic specialists, a lot of Wisconsin cheese is commodity. A lot of it ends up on frozen pizzas. But Joe used the word, artisan. These are artisans working on this smaller scale. Is that something that you think really just fits with the spirit of the Driftless region?
I think it fits with the spirit, but it also fits with the topography. Mm. We don't have the opportunity or the ability to have large-scale agricultural farms. There are, in some cases, there are locations, but it kind of lends itself to the creativity and innovation that these farmers have, because they don't have a lot of land. Andy Hatch, outside Uplands, or outside Dodgeville, Uplands Cheese, he has 90 to 150 cows. That's it. So he's figured out a way to create opportunity with the land that he has, which is not a lot. And a lot of these are hillsides. So, you know, I think it's creativity, but I think it's just the topography as well.
And Joe, I imagine one way I could get into cheese making is go out on the commodity market and buy the milk I'm going to make my cheese out of. Or I could do what I think you're doing there and having a relationship with a particular pasture. Can you talk about your sourcing?
Yeah, sure. We actually work with we're in Lafayette County, so we work with a Lafayette County co-op that is all Amish farms, because there's a lot of Amish that moved into the area. So we're talking really small farms, some of them 30 head, 25, 50, 60. So it's a collaboration of several farms in the area that are pooling the milk. So it's all small family farms.
We're talking about the cheesemaking tradition and future in the Driftless region of Wisconsin. We've got Kristen Mitchell from Little Creek Press, cheesemaker Joe Burns from Brunco Cheese. They're two of the people behind the new book, The Wisconsin Way, Cheesemaking in the Driftless. Again, that's W-H-E-Y, The Wisconsin Way. Joe, I want to dig into a particular cheese. You brought over the concept from Finland, which is a good fit, of course, for Wisconsin heritage. I'm going to ask you to help me with the pronouncer here.
So Juustolaippa is the cheese. We were introduced to this cheese by a professor in Madison who showed just whoever was interested the recipe, I don't know, 20 years ago. Nobody was making it in the United States as far as, actually it might have been made in the homes in the UP of Michigan a little bit, because there's some Finnish up there. But it wasn't being made commercially in the US as far as we knew. And we kind of ran with it, and it really flipped our factory upside down, because it was so unique and so new to the scene. And it's a unique cheese because, one, we actually physically bake it as part of making it, and then you heat it to serve it. And so when we first kind of got introduced to it, the farmers markets were a key scene for it, because you could just go out kind of guerrilla marketing, and I took it to a flame in Chicago in Lincoln Park and sampled it. And then the other people at the factory took it to Madison, to the Dane County farmers market, put it on like a hot griddle. And we were just, thousands of people every weekend were seeing it, and it just kind of snowballed from there and became this really popular, unique, whole new cheese that had never been made in the state. And that's really what's kept us going. We are really old. We're 126 years this year making cheese. And so we've gone from 180-pound wheels of Emmentaler when our Swiss, because our heritage is Swiss, to block cheddar and Colby and Jack, to now specialty and artisanal. And this is like something that really is kind of in between. It's not like a small batch of some of the artisanal stuff, but it's not a commodity either. We call it a specialty cheese. And so it's really helped us kind of survive the changing times from the 90s to the into the 2000s, as when cheese making really kind of the specialty and artisanal stuff kind of revolutionized the whole industry.
Now, Kristen, you came into this project from the publishing side of things. What are one or two of the things that struck you that you learned about cheese production in your neck of the woods?
Everything. I had no idea, truthfully. When we decided to do this project, and a little bit of the origin story of the book, Joe held a class at a culinary school we have in Mineral Point called The Book Kitchen, which is housed in the Republic of Letters. And the three of us collaborated, the Republic of Letters, The Book Kitchen, and Little Creek Press collaborated to do this project. And Joe actually started this whole ball of cheese rolling when he released a cheese called Pave Henri that he'd been working on for, could be around 10 years. Joe can correct me if I'm wrong. About 10 years. And he just had the opportunity. He made this beautiful meal for us. He educated us about just the process of creating the cheese and the smell of the cheese and how he sat on it for so long. So that was the impetus for the book. But I think that I really had no idea the volume of effort and craftsmanship that goes into making these cheeses. And there's, as you mentioned earlier, they're not all cheesemakers, right? You know, Joe's a good example. He didn't come up in cheese. Anna Landmark didn't come up in cheese. So the inspirational stories of the cheesemakers was really wonderful.
Kristen, I want to talk about how you chose the cheesemakers to feature in the book. Joe and the, I think, 11 others?
I actually, Joe chose them all.
Okay.
So we charged Joe with that right in the beginning. The only one that was kind of a one-off was there is an affinage featured in the book as well. So it's 12 cheesemakers and an affinage, an affineur who ages the cheese. So I think that's a good, better question for Joe. Plus,
okay.
I have to say it's really good for us because when people call me, which they have, and ask me why so-and-so cheesemaker is not in the book, I can just blame Joe.
Excellent. So, Joe, it must have been tough to narrow this down.
It was. And, you know, when we were kind of early starting, there was some talk about, oh, you know, maybe we would do more than one volume because there's enough to fill more than one book. So I just at the time just thought, you know, I just said, how about 12? And they thought that was a good number to start with. And I just kind of thought about, you know, who's, you know, who I guess it's obviously subjective, but who's making some of the most unique stuff. And I kind of wanted to get a wide range of products. You know, I wanted to, you know, some people are working in sheep milk, some people goat milk. There's some like incredible female cheesemakers who don't always get recognition as in the state because it's predominant male cheesemakers. But so I wanted to get a good mix of different types of people, products, you know, backgrounds. And that was just, you know, you could remove us and put someone else in and there'd be another good person. You know, there's definitely more than us 12 that should be recognized.
And Kristen, something that's coming through just sitting here and in the book is your love for the Driftless region, not just the cheese, but the place in general. How would you encourage someone wherever they might be to take a close look at the place around them? Say, what's special? How do I promote that? How do I get that message to the wider world?
I just talk to the people. You know, people like, I'll use Minter Point as an example. Minter Point is one of the most welcoming communities I have ever been in. And really, it is as simple as asking the server at the restaurant where you just had a beautiful meal, where did this come from? Who made this meal? You know, can I find them? Everybody, you know, it's another thing about, you know, the Driftless region as a whole, we're very accessible. Everybody wants to help each other. So I think it's about the community, the people in the community that know better than anybody else, or find books like ours that, you know, focus or feature one specific thing in an area.
And Joe, as we wrap up, there's a section in the book, a guide called How to Cheese. Recommendations for somebody who wants to up their cheese game, explore the wider worlds of cheese. How do you recommend somebody get started?
What's probably the most interesting to people is to actually go to the places where the cheese is made. Because most of us have a little retail store, you know, or, you know, have a way to like invite the public in a little bit, and you can kind of get a better feel for like how this whole world works just by coming out and visiting us, because we're all, you know, pretty close to each other, proximity wise. You could hit a small area, you know, and go visit three or four of us in a day trip or 2-day trip pretty easily.
We'll leave it there. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Kristen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Kristen Mitchell, founder and owner of Little Creek Press in Mineral Point, and Joe Burns, co-owner of Brunkow Cheese in Darlington, been talking about their new book. It's called The Wisconsin Way, Cheesemaking in the Driftless. It profiles 12 cheesemakers in the area who are carrying on longtime traditions and forging some new innovations in yummy gourmet cheese.
We talked about the farm bill yesterday with an ag policy reporter and provisions that are in the big spending and tax package in Congress.
We asked you how the farm bill affects your life. Fifth-generation farmer Kirsten and Cameron wrote in to say, I'm concerned about small family farms and the safety nets we use to keep farming. One very important need is affordable health care. My family is able to purchase health insurance on healthcare.gov through the Affordable Care Act.
Kristen goes on to say, if we don't have affordable health insurance, where does that leave us? Do we use a free clinic? Will free clinics be overwhelmed? Also, rural care options will be more limited. Kristen ends with this. Elected leaders are very much failing us when we very much need them.
Share your story about how these policies affect your life. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text. The number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Colleen Leahy, Joe Tarr, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.